go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, Titanic Tuesday, on the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is the horn, headonradionetwork.com. The easiest place to go to get the stream. Available only on the interweb pubes. We are not suitable for terrestrial broadcasting with all of its censorship. You can get the horn in a wide variety of places. You can get it on your smartphone via things like Tuner Internet Radio and TuneIn Radio, Dar.fm, Streama.com. You can get the podcast. The podcast address, the feed address, is at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Just look around there under Head On with Bob Kincaid. And you can also get the podcast over at iTunes. This is radio that is funded by you, the listener. You make the determination as to its worth, and I'm pleased to say that for nearly 7 years now, you have made that decision, made that choice, made that determination, and made this all happen. We seek to raise about $100 a night, $100. We fell rather short last night, which leaves us in a hole for tonight. We need to raise about $150 tonight in order to pull even with where we need to be. Remember every month that this fall that we achieve our fundraising goal for the month, $2,500. We beat the Swede, and that makes it an extra $100 to help us try to get at least a little bit something resembling ahead. So the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So is the snail mail address. I will repeat the snail mail address for those who do not want to go to all the way to headonradionetwork.com and click on the tab Contribute, although you can if you need to see it in writing. It is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318. That stands for Personal Mailbox. PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. Remember, don't make checks payable or money orders payable to Bob Kincaid or make them to the Horn or Head On Radio Network, because, you see, Bob doesn't get the money. The people to whom we pay bills get the money. The PayPal button is, of course, easy to use as well, and that enables it all goes to bill paying. And we've got oh, Jesus, it's terrifying to think of. You know, we're heading toward the middle of the month, so that means we're getting close to having a little in excess of $1,000 in bills to pay, and, well, that's where we are. So it is Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Yes, yes, Lottie, absolutely. For those of you using the snail mail address, or as the French call it, escargot mail. Oh, I can tell. It's going to be a fun evening. Escargot mail. So we had a wonderful series of conversations last night, I thought. And we can kind of pick up where we left off. We left off, of course, with the magnificent recording of Fred Rogers, modern day saint, saving PBS in testimony before the Senate of the United States in 1969. 1969, of course, the Vietnam War was still raging. Blood was still pouring out in a gusher in that poor, tormented land. Richard Nixon would eventually pretty much get caught with secret bombings in Laos and a secret invasion of Cambodia. And the war would cost lives and treasure almost untold. But newly minted president, remember he had only been inaugurated in January of 1969, newly minted president Richard Milhouse, or as Harry Truman called him back when Democrats were unafraid to speak truth to Republicans, Harry Truman called him Richard Pinhead Nixon. We had landed on the moon in 1969, that's true, Lottie. That also cost a fraction of what Vietnam was costing us. But in the midst of all of that came Fred Rogers with this idea that we could teach children something besides conflict resolution via gunfire. And Richard Nixon wanted that budget for PBS. Oh, I want it cut, Henry. Henry, we've got to cut it. That PBS is a bunch of communists. Right? And so it was that Fred Rogers went before a Senate committee, chaired by Senator Pastore, and gave goosebumps by his own admission to Senator Pastore, who closed the hearing by saying, as we noted last night on the program playing the audio, well, I think you just got your $20 million. And it has been a struggle from that day to this to keep something besides commercialized dreck and drivel from being poured constantly into the minds of our children. Last night we had an example of that with the Kids Pick the President program that was as hosted by Linda Ellerbe on Nick.com, sort of tenderizing the children for the idea that one of these days they may just have to go and get blown into their constituent parts trying to conquer ancient Persia, modern Iran. Yeah. And it is, as I said, Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Titanic Tuesday, so named for the Titanic minds, the Titanic brains of right-wingers everywhere, named after the right-wing nabob, the right-wing idiot on nearby radio, who shall go nameless, who explained, as reported by our buddy Jim, that there are fossils in the seashells, fossils of seashells, in the rock strata of what is now West Virginia, far inland and away from any ocean. Because of the movement of the Titanic plates. I just love telling that story. Because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Of course, tectonic dynamics do play into it, but they are not Titanic. I mean, I guess you could say, I mean, the plates are pretty damn big. Maybe they are Titanic. But just blithely cruising along in his right-wing ignorance, ah, it's the Titanic plates, you see. And his little knuckle-walking 3.5 listeners. Oh, okay. So you get the idea whence comes the name Titanic Tuesday. In talking, I learned something. I had not known this before. As a function of the discussion of PBS, did you know that the other that there is another channel that was founded by a government agency in an attempt to increase learning and knowledge. Yeah. It started back in 1972. This is a story from Little Green Footballs. Noting that Willard Romney's call for the end of PBS is nothing new. But noting also that in 1972, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and NASA launched an educational, informative, instructional network that was dedicated to providing literally real education through television. NASA partnered with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to do so, providing satellite time for the delivery of the channel to cable systems. After 8 years of the attempt, it was piratized. I'm sorry, I mean privatized. Originally, it had been designed to deliver course-level content to people who might not otherwise be able to access such teaching. I remember seeing it way, way, way back. And it was... It could be dry or it could be engaging. It was called the Learning Channel. Yeah, that Learning Channel. It was piratized in 1980. As the post I'm looking at notes, the channel back then mostly featured documentary content pertaining to nature, science, history, current events, medicine, technology, cooking, home improvement, and other information-based topics. Brains are apparently not good for ratings, because the ratings did therefore suck. By 1990... a controlling interest of 51% had been sold to the Financial News Network. 1991, the Financial News Network went bankrupt, and the Discovery Channel went into talks to see about buying the Learning Channel. I tell you all of this because one of the other owners of the Learning Channel was Appalachian Community Service Network. They were bought out. Their 35% ownership stake in TLC was bought out. It was in 1998 that it rebranded itself not as the Learning Channel. How dull is that?
Marvelaine, you want to watch that there Learning Channel? Well, no, Emery. What would we want to be doing any learning for?
Reminds me of that segment by the late, great Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, the prophet Bill Hicks, who remarked on having his post-show meal one evening at a Waffle House, somewhere near Nashville, sitting there by himself, eating his meal, when the server approached him and said, "What you reading for?" prophet Bill Hicks was dumbfounded by this. He said, I've been asked many times what I'm reading, but I've never been asked what I'm reading for. Well, something similar happened with The Learning Channel. What you learning for? That's just the name of the channel. I mean, there's not any real learning going on here. And in 1998, they were rebranded as TLC. Because TLC can mean so many different things, right? TLC can mean tender loving care. It can also mean Total Loser Channel. But lo and behold, guess what one of the flagship programs is this season of the TLC that was begun as a means of information delivery? And they had some fascinating stuff. I used to watch it all the time. Back when A&E was just all Hitler all the time, you could always go to the Learning Channel and when you got all Hitlered out. And they'd have something there on bugs or leaves or why it rains. Things that fundamentalists actually, you would hope they might accidentally watch and go, you mean it ain't God a-making the rain? Marvelline, I think I ought to change the name. He says it ain't God makes the rain. I think we ought to change the name of this year channel to the Heathen Channel. But lo and behold, that little effort that began as an attempt to deliver real information, well, their latest big hit is Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child. Really. I don't know, Marty. Does TLC also have Long Island Medium? I saw a spoof of that on Saturday Night Live this past week. Is that real? Who here has a dead grandfather named Sal? All the hands go up. So, in the short space of 40 years, we have gone from an attempt to convey meaningful, worthwhile information to innocent viewers, to Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child. Dear God. Thanks, Lottie, in the chat room. I think they're running a special on exorcism for dinosaur bones. Jesus. But that's where we are. Oh, TLC. Okay. Irish Dave says, Bob, every New Yorker knows that's the Taxi Licensing Commission. God. So that's just somewhere to consider. That's another one of those little signposts that are out there, telling us where we are and how we got here. The conversion of an information delivery channel into a vehicle for Here Come Honey Boo Boo Child. Or as it is sometimes referred to, poverty exploitation. Poor exploitation. Jesus. No wonder they want to get rid of PBS, right? And I'm sure somewhere along the way we will ask the Republicans nicely not to PBS, please. Which reminds me of something Ron and Raleigh wrote in last night that I didn't get to on the show, but I wanted to make sure made it into this one. Under the subject of the meme that bothers me, Ron and Raleigh writes, the meme that bothers me from the Democratic power structure is the, we need to ask the rich to give a little more, no, I think we've got the wrong voice there. We need to ask the rich to give a little more in taxes. Ron and Raleigh asking, when the hell did we become Oliver Twist, going to the rich with our little gruel bowl in our hands, asking, please, Mr. Romney, can we have some more? There are more of us than there are of them, Ron notes. I suggest we smack them and take the money. That is, if we can wake up the Stockholm Syndrome sufferers and stop kissing the one percenters' asses. True, true, and true. Ron also knows, Bob, I'm so old, I remember when there was history on the History Channel. Now it's all about miscreants hand fishing or goobers chopping down trees or crabbing in the Bering Straits. Right, because the American people don't want none of that larning. If we wanted none any more of that larning, we wouldn't have done quit school in the eighth grade. Had all the larning we needed. We could cipher and do our gazettas. Learned how to use one of them nickel squirters like a streetcar conductor. It, by the way, you do know when you see the occasional rerun of the Beverly Hillbillies. You do know they were from Arkansas, right? Not Kentucky, not that. Now, Granny Moses, Daisy Moses, was said to have been from the hills of Tennessee. But her daughter married that Jed Clampett with the blind spot about the Indians, and he was from Arkansas. Not too far from Bug Tussle. I say that because we had two Arkansans on the program last night. I mean, no, we didn't call them in and talk to them or anything. It would have taken too long for them to dial with their toes. But you remember Messrs. Hubbard and, oh, what was the other doofus twaddle's name? The one was asking the incredibly relevant, at least to Teabagger's question, why don't black folks appreciate what we done for them by bringing them to this year country? And the other doofus twaddle saying, you know what I want? I want to be able, I think, you know, and it was our buddy Waggy in the chat room who really expressed this quite perfectly. The field of child development isn't really complete until it has a credible death threat. That's what Waggy said. Yeah, what was this goober's name? Oh, yeah, how could I forget? Goddess of irony moment. Charles Fuqua. Fuqua. He's the one who cited Deuteronomy 21:18-21 that says that you're supposed to call your son a glutton and a drunkard and have him stoned to death outside the city walls. Because, you know, rules for Bronze Age wandering nomadic tribes are perfectly suited to 21st century civilization. Perfectly suited. 2012 is when Brother Fuqua wrote the book, God's Law, The Only Political Solution. You'll recall he said that having a credible death threat for children would teach children the importance of respect for parents. Like Waggy said, the field of child development is incomplete until we have a credible death threat. Irish Dave. Mother Hubbard must be so proud. But is Ganny Eva... Ganny Eva. Oh, I just caught that Irish Dave. Proud of Paul Brown? He's a doctor, you know. Bill in Cleveland, Mr. Stress, asking, Bob, cable TV preachers and pro wrestlers, which is the most phony? I would submit to you that it is the TV preacher. Because if you ask a pro wrestler off stage and off the clock whether it's real or not, oh, hell no. I went on Friday, and the Mass Marvel wins on Saturday, down to the Armory. But the TV preacher, oh, no, brother. No, he won't admit that it's all baloney until he thinks he's by himself. You know, they're naked in that high roller suite in the Rio in Vegas with the roll away slot machine, naked with a bag of Cheetos, you know, and a little boy. Ganny Eva. Eva Brown, get it? Oh, God. Well, all of that is a setup to let you know that, yes, there is apparently a mad race on in Arkansas to out Moran the other right-wingers. We offer you today State Representative Loy Mauch. Let me tell you a story about a man named Mauch. A dumb tea bagger about smart as a rock. You get the idea. He's picking up where Brother Hubbard left off. Old Brother Hubbard, whose brains were of poo. You get the idea. State Representative Leroy Mauch has been dinged by a newspaper called the Arkansas Times for the fact that he turns out to be, and why are we surprised, an unreconstructed Confederate, too. He likes to write to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, which has a brilliant columnist. I started reading him way, way, way back with Bart Kopp, named Gene Lyons. But Representative Loy Mauch, or Pig Lickin', wrote this. If slavery were so god-awful, why didn't Jesus or Paul condemn it? Why was it in the Constitution? And why wasn't there a war before 1861? The South has always stood by the Constitution and limited government. When one attacks the Confederate battle flag, he is certainly denouncing these principles of government as well as Christianity. See, when dumb as a rock Mauch looks at the Confederate flag, he, being quite pale and quite pink, doesn't think of sheet and pillowcase clad riders in the night, bearing ropes and torches and firearms, and the aforementioned flag. He thinks of limited government, and he don't understand why the black folk don't think of limited government. But that statement, if slavery were so god-awful, why didn't Jesus or Paul condemn it? Not only did Paul not condemn it, Paul sanctioned it, which is another reason to walk away from that hateful 3,000-year-old book of fairy tales. Slaves, be obedient to your masters, as the church is to Christ. A little bit later we get, wives, be obedient to your husbands, as the church is to Christ. They keep coming up with these metaphors that make it clear that people who follow Christ are no better than second, third, fourth, fifth class non-citizens, because remember, neither slaves nor women folk were citizens. Jesus? I think Jesus did condemn it. By implication. Had he not been condemning it, he wouldn't have been hanging out with poor folks. He would not have bothered to speak to slaves for whom there was no hope. But that by implication thing is way too much for dumb as a rock mock. By the way, in case you were wondering, his campaign for re-election this year is backed by the Republican Party of Arkansas. Remember a few years back when somebody went in and shot up state Democratic Party headquarters in Arkansas? You ever wonder why? Because this is the Republican Party of Arkansas. Oh, what else? From Dumb as a Rock Mock. The Confederate flag is a symbol of Christian liberty versus the New World Order. Said that Abraham Lincoln was a Marxist. I don't know, is that even temporally possible? Let's find out. What year was the Communist Manifesto published? Man, the interweb tubes are slow here today. 1848, that's what I thought. So, how long did it take before it was translated into English? How much longer did it take before it got across the pond? But in light of the fact that Abraham Lincoln had been a In light of the fact that Abraham Lincoln had been a railroad company corporate lawyer, perhaps even drafting some broad form deeds that dispossessed people of their land and so forth before he went into politics, I think it's a bit much to suggest that he was a Marxist. I mean, he didn't even have one score of years to refer to if he wanted to talk about the Communist Manifesto. Back in 2004, Dumb as a Rock Mock organized a conference in praise of John Wilkes Booth, demanding the removal of a statue of Abraham Lincoln from somewhere in Arkansas. Now that he's been caught, the Republican Party... Him? We knew him not. Cock-a-doodle-doo. By the way, Charlie Fuqua that I mentioned again a little bit ago, Charlie doesn't just want to stone disobedient children. He wants to expel all Muslims from the United States of America. All of them. Every last one, man, woman, and child. Goodbye now. Which is going to suck for Charlie Fuqua when he gets carted into an emergency room somewhere in maybe Little Rock or Fayetteville or God knows where. If Fritz is listening, he can tell me. I don't know where the medical school for the University of Arkansas is. And instead of having a competent Muslim physician to deal with his chest pains and numbness down his left arm, there's not going to be anybody. Oh, we're sorry, Mr. Oh, we're sorry, representing Fuqua. You done run the doctor that was going to save your life out of the country because he was a Muslim. Would you like for us to pray over you, brother? Really? It happens, you know. Bless her heart. Agnes went for a checkup and to get her prescriptions refilled and so forth. And after the doctor said he wasn't going to refill her prescriptions because he wasn't sure that she had the disorder that had previously been diagnosed by two or three different healthcare providers, he did offer to pray with her. He prayed over Agnes. Really? Not kidding. Prayed. And just as a postscript to all of this, in case there's any remaining doubt, dumb as a rock, Mock, representing Loy Mock, proudly displays his endorsement by the National Rifle Association and Arkansas Right to Life. That's your Arkansas Republican Party update for the day. Whew! Marty asking, I wonder how Mr. Fuqua is about we agnostics or atheists. Do you really need to ask, Marty? You can just leave along with the Muslims. Ron and Raleigh noting, hey, Bob, I think it's time. You know how all these movies are being rebooted? I say it's time to reboot Birth of a Nation. It could be called Birth of a Nation Redux. I can see the tagline, history writ in lightning, again. Ooh, in color and sound and everything, the Klan scenes will just be awesome. And the dumbass crackers will go out in droves to see it. Dr. John, with an observation, Lincoln a Marxist? No. And answering my previous question, most of Marx's writings weren't in English until well into the 20th century. Aside from that, it's absurd on its face. But I don't think we can cast that aside so easily, Dr. John. That, because I'm not willing to bet that representing Fuqua is a reader of Die Deutsch. Are you? Can't you just see him, Charlie, there? With his lips moving and his finger under the print. Hobbins in Hop. Give. Hobbin. Hop. Give Warden. Marveline, is this Marxism? Yeah. the Marxist Lincoln. That and the John Wilkes Booth Festival, of course. Yes, yes, you've got it right, Marty. So, Arkansas Right to Life endorses a candidate who calls for the stoning to death of disobedient children? That pro-life Arkansas Right to Life? Yes, that one. Regarding the Birth of a Nation reboot, Marty says, let's get Spike Lee to make it. Jim with a nice observation. Please explain this stoning with the parable of the prodigal son who welcomed his the father who welcomed his son and did not stone him. Well, see, Jim, I think that's one of those moments where we understand that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, was not completely down with the law. Because remember, the child was to be stoned to death for being rebellious and not willing to listen to the admonitions of his mother and father. Now, son, I don't think you ought to go off and go wandering around the desert seeking your fortune like that. It's not a good idea. Screw you, Dad. I'm going to go to Nineveh. The bright lights in the big city. Harlots. Son, don't make me stone you to death. Goodbye, Dad. But you should recognize that parents love their children. And when the prodigal son returns, he kills the fatted calf. And his brother is sitting there, and he looks at his dad and says, hey, Dad, I've done everything you wanted. I've sat here and I've worked my tail off. You never threw a party and killed the fatted calf for me. And you can understand where the other son's coming from. In a way, I think you can see this as Yeshua, who had done the same thing, wandered away from the family business, gone out to talk to God in the desert, went and hung out with that no good hippie cousin John of his. Sorry, I'm not trying to turn this into Wednesday night prayer meeting a day early or anything, but Jim asked the question. Jesus, because dumb as a rock mock, asked the question, if slavery was so god-awful, why didn't Jesus or Paul condemn it? Well, we understand that he did. That by merely hanging out with them, but that's way too deep for dumb as a rock, Mark. Dr. John representing Fuqua. Oh no, I bet he learned German just so he could read Hegel in the original tongue. Jesus. It's gonna be that kind of evening. Speaking of German, Irish Dave noting, No, it should be Grossmutter Eva Brown. That's the Georgia representative noted last night who said that all that biology and evolution and Big Bang, I'm a doctor, I done been through school, and it's all lies from the pits of hell. Does that man still practice medicine, or does he just spend all his time the congressating? Because I think we should stop all shipments of things like flu and pneumonia vaccines to his office, being how it's based on evolutionary biology and everything. But this truly is a Titanic Tuesday. And we're barely scratching the surface, if you can imagine that. I have in front of me here audio published by the Nation magazine. It is unique. It is history making. This is the only known extant recording of the modern manifestation of keeping those people in line via the New York City Police Department stop and frisk program. It is just now breaking. It is brand new out. I don't know. Did you hear this earlier in the day? Have you heard anybody talk about this? It concerns the stop and frisk on June the 3rd, 2011, of a Harlem teenager named Alvin, under suspicion of LWB, living while brown. Alvin's one of those crafty little devils, however, and he turned on the recorder on his cell phone. What you're going to hear is about 2 minutes long, and I'm going to play it for you in its entirety because, once again, this is one of those journalism moments we find ourselves in periodically, where I'm going to play you something that the for-profit media cannot play you without putting in boops for your tender, unsuspecting ears, because we can't actually be playing for the American people audio of cops talking like cops really talk. Because we have to understand that they're Jesus' first line of defense against rebellious children who need to be taken outside the city gates and stoned, for they are gluttons and drunkards. Alvin was stopped. The cops didn't give any reason for stopping him except for the fact that he was sitting there being Alvin. Along the way, he does have the presence of mind to at least ask the question, "Why are you threatening to arrest me?" Well, this is that audio. Here we go.
I just got stopped like 2 blocks ago, yo.
You look very suspicious.
Because y'all always looking at me crazy.
Because you keep looking back at us, man.
Because you always... But y'all always looking crazy, yo. Coming up the block, always.
That's our job, man.
Listen to me.
Our job is to look suspicious behavior. When you keep looking at us like that, looking back...
Because y'all always, like, stop. I just got stopped like 2 blocks away, like...
Because you keep doing that shit, man. We stopped you last time. Listen to me. When you were walking the block with your hood up and you keep looking back at us like that, you think you might have something.
Because I had my hoodie in there.
Did you do that? You have your hoodie on your body.
Why? Well, because it was cold.
You're
going to smack me. Yeah. You want to smack me? No, you asked me why I have a boot bag on.
Who are you talking to?
You asked me why I had a boot bag on.
You
asked me if I had a boot bag on.
Yo,
why are you... Come on, why are you touching me for?
You want to go to jail?
For what?
Shut
what?
Your fucking mouth, kid.
Why am I getting arrested
Shut
for?
Shut your mouth.
What am I getting arrested for?
For being a fucking mutt, you know what?
Oh, so that's a law? Being a mutt? You don't mean to tell me why I have a good bag on my hoodie? Why are you putting it on my arm with
bag? Shut your fucking mouth.
Because you're asking me questions. I'm answering your questions.
Weren't you a fucking explorer at one point?
I was, and I
fucking respect.
Because that stopped me. You always stop me for no reason.
You want somebody talking to you?
Why you pushing?
I'm going to break your fucking arm.
You're going to break my arm. For what?
I'm
going to
fucking break your arm.
For what?
Who's your father?
You're going to punch me in my face?
What's your father's name? Where's your work?
Where? He's not going to answer. He don't got a phone.
You're in traffic?
Nope. Yup.
He's a traffic cop?
Yup. Don't touch me. Okay, he's a traffic cop. Why you piss me off for? Why you piss me off for? Why you piss me off for?
Why
you piss me off? Why you
piss me off?
Why you
fucking
war? Why
you fucking women? You fucking shit!
Yo, why you
piss
me that? Why you piss me that? Now I'm calling the cops just for that one.
Today's program is brought to you by the letter B. B is for brutality. B is for brute. B is for beast. You gotta. Now the beeps in there, you understand, are because he's given his father's name, and that's a matter of privacy. Irish Dave pointing out, Jesus, Bob. It's a well-known true fact that Alvin is gang-affiliated. I think they're called the Chipmunks. It's mighty hard to stomach that audio. I understand Dave's levity. But that's any day. That's any day in New York. That's any day in any big city. Did you hear the explanation? We're roughing you up because you looked at us. You looked at us. You keep looking back at us. Well, Jesus, he's a dark-skinned American male, and he's got the cops eyeballing him. I'd be looking back, too. Yeah, you look suspicious like that. Is this the part of the program where we cue up Lee Greenwood? And I'm proud to live in America. Yeah. But Alvin was a little smarter than they thought he was. Now I'm sure they'll probably try to come down on him for recording them without permission. That is so troubling. And these weren't just beat cops. These were plainclothes cops, so you wouldn't necessarily know, technically, that they were cops. They're just three guys that are watching your every move and your back is turned to them. Alvin says he grabbed me by the book bag. And he started pushing me down, so I'm going backwards, like down the hill, and he just kept pushing me. It looked like he was going to hit me. I felt like he was trying to make me resist or fight back. Alvin's a pretty smart young man, because that's exactly what they were doing. In the city of New York, by its own data, the New York Police Department stops and frisks without warrant, without probable cause, without anything resembling constitutional authority, over 1,800 people inside the city every day. Now, in a city of 11 million, I guess that's not that many, but it's plenty enough. The New York Times reports that more than 20% of those 1,800 stops per day involve the use of force. And those are the sanitary records of the New York Police Department. Folks are reporting on their own things that are events that are much more dangerous, much more charged, and happen much more frequently. The interesting thing is that New York City police officers, some, and they are brave ones, have also come forward to point out the damage that the stop and frisk policy has done to their ability to do real law enforcement in the city. Now, bear in mind, of course, that Mayor Michael Bloomberg thinks it's just really neato peachy keen. Ben Jealous, president of the NAACP, told the Nation, "The tape brings to light what so many New Yorkers have experienced in the shadows at the hands of the NYPD. It is time for Mayor Bloomberg to come to grips with the scale of the damage his policies have inflicted on our children and their families. No child should have to grow up fearing both the cops and the robbers." But this is America. This is the national security state. And a national security state, and let's be honest, a national security empire, lives in perpetual fear. And the single greatest impediment to freedom is fear. Why do you think that FDR said, "All we have to fear is fear itself"? Because, as a book puts it, fear is the little death. Fear is the mind killer. And so the empire is afraid, and in turn projects that fear onto the citizens of empire. And yes, this is a problem in New York City. But don't think it's not a problem in other places as well. And don't think it's a city thing. It's a rural thing, too. Because the rise of the police state accompanies the rise of empire. And that's why, time and time again, I try so hard to make certain that we understand that this is empire. We like to get all warm and fuzzy on the 4th of July and think back to those powdered wig-wearing, the silken-hosed, knee-pants-wearing framers of the Constitution. But this is not that. This is empire. Now, that audio is from June 2011. It predates the slaughter of Trayvon Martin. But you notice the young man was profiled, as the audio notes, the young man was profiled for his hoodie. As Ron in Raleigh points out, it's a damn good thing that he wasn't packing Arizona iced tea and Skittles. But I told you, it's not just a New York City thing. Oh, hell no. This story goes back to the end of September, over a week ago. Digby reporting. The story of an epileptic man in Vermont. The news story Digby quotes reads as follows. An electrical discharge from a Vermont state trooper's taser weapon caused the death of a Thetford man 3 months ago outside his home, the New Hampshire Medical Examiner's Office advised Vermont State Police on Friday. McAdam Mason, aged 39, suffered sudden cardiac death due to conducted electrical weapon discharge, Vermont State Police reported late Friday afternoon. Late Friday afternoon, how about that? The news dump. Nobody will notice this if we get it out late on Friday. In a statement relaying the conclusions from Mason's autopsy in New Hampshire, Mason died June 20th outside his Thetford home after Senior Trooper David Schaefer fired his taser at Mason's chest. The finding on the cause of death spurred more calls for change in how Vermont law enforcement officers are trained on and use tasers. How are they going to change it? We're going to have a law where citizens with epilepsy or heart disorder have to wear a big sign, "Tase me, bro, epileptic." People on the scene told police that McAdam Mason was epileptic. They told police he was epileptic. They told police he was having a mental break after a seizure. They begged. This is all before the fact, mind you, because they begged. I mean, there are people standing begging the police not to taser this man. And Senior Trooper David Schaefer killed him anyway. As Digby points out, as part and parcel of this is the fact that the New Hampshire Medical Examiner's Office said that he had that McAdam Mason had other significant conditions, and said that he had excited delirium syndrome. This is important because excited delirium syndrome is a made-up load of BS that has been created as a diagnosis after you get killed by a taser. Digby writes, "I don't need to reiterate the absolute pile of stinking garbage that is Taser International's favorite syndrome called excited delirium. All this means is that if you're stressed when a policeman kills you with a taser, it's your fault for dying." The company that manufactures tasers has helped to fund the research that has established the existence of excited delirium syndrome. A spokesman for Taser has explained, Digby says, over at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Tuttle defended the safety of the taser, noting the National Institute of Justice concluded that there is no conclusive medical evidence in the current body of research literature that indicates a high risk of serious injury or death to humans from the direct or indirect cardiovascular or metabolic effects of short-term taser exposure in healthy, normal, non-stressed, non-intoxicated persons. Well, let's go over that for a minute. One, since when is the National Institute of Justice a credible clearinghouse for medical information? And then there's that adjective, conclusive. There's no conclusive medical evidence. that tasering people leads to them upping and dying. Conclusive. That means that there is evidence, but they're choosing to overlook it because they're going to say it's not conclusive. And then that it's further qualified by saying that there's no conclusive medical evidence that when you taser a person who is healthy, normal, non-stressed, and non-intoxicated, because those are the people that the cops taser the most. You know, hey, look, Joe, look over there. We got a healthy, normal, non-stressed, non-intoxicated person. Bet we can taser him. No, instead they show up in front of a man's house who has a disability and has lived but 39 short years on this little blue planet. And they kill him. So in all of that BS, no conclusive medical evidence that indicates risk of serious injury or death to humans from direct or indirect cardiovascular or metabolic effects, short-term taser exposure, healthy, normal, non-stressed, non-intoxicated person. Man, that is stretching the bounds of definitional parameters to their snapping point. So in other words, can we conclude that there is conclusive medical evidence in the current body of research literature that indicates a high risk of serious injury or death to humans from the direct or indirect cardiovascular or metabolic effects of short-term taser exposure in unhealthy, abnormal, stressed-out, intoxicated persons? It's kind of what that says, isn't it? Like I said, that happened in Vermont. Alvin got stopped in New York. A lady in Alta Vista, Virginia, got blown away, 83 years old, within feet, within reaching distance, she could fall over and die on the steps of her sister's home. And they blew her away. Keep your head down, citizen. Don't make any waves. Don't participate in the political process. Don't protest. Don't march. And maybe, just maybe, if you're lucky, you won't get all killed and stuff. You got it? Here ends the evening filibobster. It is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, Tuesday, the 9th day of October, 2012. I'm Bob Kincaid. Your calls are welcome. You know the number, right? 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This is conversation radio that you make happen. This is The Horn.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep cause my bed's on fire. Don't ask me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho. Run, run, run.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Past 7 p.m. here in the Eastern Remaining Daylight Time Zone. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Welcome to hour number two. Email coming in immediately prior to and during the break. That I thought you might find interesting. Oh, by the way, good news. Of that $150 we needed to raise this evening, $100 of it came in one kind, incredibly generous contribution. Thank you very, very much. That leaves only 50 to break even for this evening and set us up to be on track tomorrow and the day after and the day after. Thank you. Thank you very much. Every time something comes in, all of us know that it represents a sacrifice of one degree or another. And that drives... that drives the sense of humility and gratitude that attends all of this. Kevin writing in from Colorado Springs, and I'm going back to the phones in a moment. Light them up if you want to. Kevin says, ah, yes, America's police forces at their very best. How many incidents in just the past 2 weeks have we heard of police behaving badly? Has the Justice Department investigated one of them? No, not as far as I know. There is a war going on for any minority in this country, whether it's the crime of being black, a woman who wants to be in charge of her own body, a war against being disabled, as well as in the case of the double amputee being killed. Yeah, that was in Houston, right? Yeah. And then Jack from Shreveport reminds me of another story. He heard it on Malloy last night. I had seen this story as well, and I had almost, thank you, Jack, for reminding me, let it slip from my attention. And we ought not let these kinds of things happen, because if no one else remembers, let us at least note. If it doesn't make the evening news, let us at least note. Because, as that line from Death of a Salesman puts it, attention must be paid. Wetumpka, Alabama. It's an Indian word, naturally. That's all. That's about all that remains, although there are some native peoples yet in Alabama, Stan. Much of what remains of the brilliant native culture that existed in the Southeast is only in the names. Words like Wetumpka, that we can only guess at what it meant. But Wetumpka, Alabama is a close-knit little southern community, as you would expect it to be. And a young man, I don't have the story in front of me because the computer is behaving badly. Very badly, I might add. Bad to the point of I got to restart. So goodbye, chat room. And a young man and two of his other friends were as close as could be there in Wetumpka growing up. And one of the three, they all played baseball together. One of the three also was a wrestler. And this year he was a freshman. See, you know where this is going because you keep hearing the verb tense, don't you? One of them, although his friend said had he wanted to, he could have wrestled at the college level. He was a little fella, maybe 100, I mean, not a little fella, but he was 150 pounds or so, maybe 5'8", 5'9". But he decided just to go to college. And so this story just messed with me badly when I first read it. Thank you, Jack, again for reminding me of it. Because we're going through some of it with our own, talking about colleges and filling out forms and how do we get it paid for and where will you go. And I think about the conversations that must have taken place around the dinner table for this young man in Wetumpka, Alabama. Didn't go to Auburn, didn't go to Alabama, didn't go to any of the other fine state universities. He went to one of the largest and fastest growing state universities in Alabama. He went to USA. In the far northwest corner of Alabama is UNA, the University of North Alabama. And in the far southwest corner, almost a straight line 350 miles south, is the University of South Alabama at Mobile. You know I have a particular fondness for Mobile, sitting there on the Gulf. We even talked a little bit about Margie maybe going to the University of South Alabama. I think that one's out now. But somewhere along the way, this young man did something that young college students away from home for the first time are sometimes prone to do. Apparently, he got all effed up. Drunk, drugs, we don't know what. I'm not going to speculate. But he was away at college. At the University of South Alabama. A college freshman. Jesus Christ. Who did something Look, here's how it breaks. He was naked. Outside, naked. Not naked in his dorm room. Outside, naked. It was 1:30 a.m. Saturday this past. Saturday morning, 1:30 a.m. has a way of following Friday nights on college campuses and in the rest of the world. Gil Collar, 18 years old, allegedly charged a campus cop. As noted, he was naked. The campus cop repeatedly told him to stop, allegedly, and then drew his pistol and shot Gil Collar of Wetumpka, Alabama, pride and joy of his mama and daddy, once in the chest, helping Gil Collar to stop being Gil Collar and transform immediately into a corpse. An autopsy will determine if drugs or alcohol were involved. Just like an autopsy determined that McAdam Mason, Thetford, Vermont, suffered from, what? What's the term? Thanks, Dr. John. Excited delirium syndrome. Dr. John noting that it has been recognized by the American College of Emergency Physicians, the largest professional organization of emergency health care providers in the U.S. Dr. John also notes, from what I can tell, it has not been recognized by the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, a much smaller professional group of the same sort, which is concerned with the corporate practice of medicine and the negative consequences related to patient care. John saying, again, for what that's worth. Indeed. And I think it is worth something. Excited delirium syndrome is a convenient out. It's a way to keep medical and law enforcement staff professionals, so-called, from having to say, man, he's just all effed up, and I didn't have no choice but to blow him away. Now, you're a cop. And, by the way, campus cops in Alabama are clothed with the authority of the Alabama State Police. What did he think the naked 5'8", 150-pound kid with no weapon was going to do to him? Why did he go for the gun and not, you know, the pepper spray? God knows we've seen that stuff abused. But cops are armed with all manner of weaponry. But he went straight for the gun. Stories like that, stories like all of these, just give me the six. They're unbearable. I can't begin to imagine the pain of the young man's parents and his friends. God. So what, was the cop 5'4" and 120 pounds? But that's how empires behave. Can we please, pretty please, understand that? This is behavior in empire. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I guess that streaking is no longer in vogue.
I would say one streaks at one's own peril, at least on the campus of the University of South Alabama.
Yeah, I guess so. That's
emphasis on the word peril.
Yeah, that's indeed regrettable. Absolutely. I can remember back in the 70s when streaking was, well, it was...
I remember when Ray Stevens made a small fortune off of a novelty song about it.
Yeah? Oh, yeah.
Now he's out there writing songs about how Obama is a Muslim.
And it was a hell of a lot of fun, too.
You say, are you saying that as a former streaker, Jim?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just checking.
Absolutely. And so, wherein lies the harm? I mean, you know, I just, when you brought that to mind, or on your broadcast, I immediately thought back to 1974, when, you know, that was the thing that kids did, and it passed. Nobody was killed. And
I remember, wasn't there a streaker at a baseball game or something once? And
yeah.
Didn't somebody streak Johnny Carson?
I don't remember that, but I let me put it this way. I've seen enough streaking to know that it doesn't really cause any harm except to cause some old lady a case of the phantods or whatever.
Right, I remember Ray Stevens' remark along the lines of, he got her in the frozen foods.
Yeah, and I've been streaked myself in like restaurants and bars and even in a grocery store. And my only reaction was, well, at least he was young and well formed and could move quickly. Didn't bother me.
Right.
To me, it was a visual treat. I enjoyed it.
But on this past Friday night,
no,
on a lonely corner in the University of South Alabama campus, he was the naked boy was a menace, was a threat.
Well, unfortunately, that shows the times, how times have changed and how people's reaction formation to anything other than complete and total equipoise is, well, you take your life into your own hands, that's for sure.
Right. The message is, do not deviate from the norm, citizen.
No. Unfortunately, that's the way it is now. Times have changed. Times have gotten a lot harder. And people are even more and more menacing in their attitude toward anything that does not coincide with what they consider to be normal functioning behavior. And as far as tasers are concerned, I mean, you know, the United Nations has addressed that. If I'm not mistaken, I think the United Nations Committee Against Torture has on many occasions admonished the use of a taser. I'm not sure how many thousands of volts a taser can deliver. Is it 20?
I'm not. I think they come in varying voltages, but I don't know of any mild tasers.
Well, there's.
I mean, they are designed to cripple and incapacitate.
Well, there's one call. I think it's the nomenclature is like X26 or something like that, and I'm not sure what the voltage delivery is, but it's pretty severe, and it can certainly get your attention, if not kill you. It can cause cardiac arrhythmia and things of that nature. It's not something that you use just as a toy, and in certain hands, it has become a toy, I think. I remember watching that film Casino. You ever see that movie?
Yeah, oh yes.
Remember the guy they thought was cheating, and so how they got his attention was and got him off the floor was to taser him.
Yep.
And take him in the back room and, of course, give him the old threat of the bandsaw treatment.
It was a great movie.
Yeah, it was. Kind of frightening in a way, but nonetheless, very, very, disturbing.
Oh, the look on Joe Pesci's face when he realized he was not going to get made after all. Oh,
well,
no.
I mean, I think we're talking about Goodfellas.
Oh, that was Goodfellas. My bad. No.
That's
yeah, Casino's the one where Sharon Stone goes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Oh. I get my mob movies confused sometimes.
How dare you? I mean, they seem to be on TV such a some type of pattern of expected behavior from people, and they're lionized. Like I said the other, I think it was last week or whenever last time I talked to you, the mob wives of New York.
Oh God.
That's just a real lovely thing to hear all these. Well, you really can't tell what their dialogue is because all the expletives are deleted and all the, you know.
Yeah, it's a single note symphony of bleeps.
Well, it's not about, these people, in my opinion, nothing but, they're criminals. And yet they are being paid to have a camera there on focus with them, with a recorder, to see a bunch of women who are, in my opinion, just trash, just absolute trash, mob women whose husbands are either incarcerated or in a halfway house or whatever. You know, like Rene Graziano. Is that the type of image that they want to really project on TV?
Sure it is, if there's somebody that's willing to buy an advertisement in the middle of it.
Yeah, well...
Because, I mean, you know, drop this into the same category as Long Island Medium. Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child. We have become our own freak show, Jim.
Well, yeah. Which is the reason I kind of stay away from that. I mean, I flip over it, and I hear a couple lines of it from people like Rene Graziano and some of the other girlfriends she has, and how they can't get together in a restaurant or a home and without having a fight. And I mean, who in the hell wants to see mob wives having sauna parties? That's the latest one that I heard about, and I said, this is...
There is a demographic identified by advertisers out there who obviously do, and they are desperately in need of having advertisements delivered to them. It's one of those moments where we have to come to grips, Jim, with the fact that so-called entertainment in the for-profit media is not about entertainment. It is about finding a vehicle that will deliver advertising content to people in chairs far, far away. By the way, Ron in Raleigh, with a little update information for us both, Jim. He says, here you go. There's a common misconception about the voltage of tasers. Yes, they are 50,000 volts, but that is only to make the initial contact between the taser probes and the skin. Once contact is made, the voltage drops to about 1,200 volts at about 19 pulses per second. The voltage has nothing to do with the strength of the taser or any stun gun. You can go touch a Van der Graaff generator with 2 million volts, and the only things that will happen to you is your hair will stand up.
Well,
amperage,
right.
Amperage is where the power is. And tasers deliver about 0.02 to 0.04 amps and about 1 to 2 joules of power. A heart defibrillator delivers about 1 to 2 amps and up to 400 joules of power. Your vacuum cleaner runs on about 12 amps and about 300 joules. So theoretically, it's not that big a dose, but it's plenty big a dose considering the voltage of the human, you know, the human machine.
Well, the thing about it is, it can stop the human machine, period.
Cold.
That's it. I mean, it can cause cardiac arrhythmia.
And anything that requires that the people it be used on be normal, unstressed, sober, et cetera, et cetera, in that litany of things that it's harmless to. Well, there's too great a risk in that arena of conduct that the people you're going to run up against aren't any of those things.
Well, I'm sure that they certainly don't run any type of physical profile on the person before they taser them.
Oh, heck no.
So, I mean, you know, it's catch as catch can. That's just the way it is. If you really want to hear somebody who talks about New York police practices, you ought to listen to Bo Beetle.
Oh, God, yeah, I know who you're talking about.
One tough cop. He's on IMUS every Monday morning, or used to be. And he's the one who makes up all these words and stuff like this and has the tie and hanky combo. And, you know, I used to find him amusing in a certain extent. But this guy is just plain downright mean and cruel. By the same token, attempts to portray himself as a positive element of society. I've just never had much use for these new centurions myself, because I've never seen one when I needed one. You know, if you're there on the road with a flat tire, I don't think you're going to find too many of them that will help you change it.
No, that's why in this state, for instance, we created an entirely separate cadre of underpaid service workers whose job is to drive around and respond to people in need of help. We can't be bothering the police to carry a spare gallon of gas in their trunk or anything.
No, I guess not. And I just wonder how frequently these underpaid service workers are available to you in a time of need.
They will, depending on the budget, because Well, we understand budgets. They will show up. I mean, I've had help from them. You've got to have a way of reaching them, though. So good luck to you if you don't have a cell phone.
Yeah, that is true. Well, that's at least one element that's maybe not going to taser you or help you off the road if you're in distress.
Right.
But it's really unfortunate that the police are becoming more and more like, in certain cases, oh God, like the brown shirts.
Oh, by the way, getting back to streaking just for a minute, Beth down in Texas says at Rice University, streaking is almost mandatory for members of Baker College. It's a hallowed tradition called Baker 13. When my daughter was at Baker 20 years ago, I had the usual worries about a daughter away from home, but I never feared she would be killed by the university police employed to protect her. So apparently, and she sends this notation along about Baker 13.
Oh, my word.
And says, there are a few things more exhilarating than being outdoors while naked. This is one of the purposes of Baker 13. Sorry, we're not naked. We're wearing cream, shaving cream, that is. Menthol, if you're daring. It tingles. So here's how it goes. On the 13th and 31st of the month, or on the 26th, if that month doesn't have a 31st, at around 10 p.m., the Baker 3rd entrance door bursts open to the screams of 13. Join us, 13, followed by anywhere from 2 to 196 naked, creamy males and females. The two big runs are Halloween. The record was in 1995 at 196. Last run of the school year, April 26th. Fewer people run in December and January, where it can get to be this cold out. Ask a regular to tell you about the expression.
You mean they have to wear shaving cream over their
yes.
private part?
Yes.
Oh, God, Bob, that's no fun.
Purist.
I mean, how many women shave their arms and put aftershave on them after they do it?
See, you're
just
a purist. That's all you are.
I guess so. I was just thinking about how things used to be and just how grim they have become now, and what you see on television. I mean, yet you know they will enthuse about the mob wives. Yet these see people who sit there and watch these pieces of trash will then again tell you how much they hate PBS, which is a totally benevolent, very kind way of teaching people how to live and treat each other right. I saw Fred Rogers, the thing on the internet yesterday of his testimony before that senator. And
it does give you goosebumps, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, you just compare and contrast what was then and what's now. And, of course, Mr. Romney's virulent attack upon PBS. And it's pretty bad. It really is. It leaves one somewhat exhausted, actually, when you consider it. In a not very good frame of mind, actually. One thing I did want to mention, Encore, speaking of television, this is Titanic Tuesday.
Yes, indeed.
There is a program I emailed you about called Titanic Blood and Steel, and it deals with the construction of the Titanic. It's sort of a melodrama-type thing, but I'm sure it probably has a kernel of truth in it. And one of the leading characters in it is played by Kevin Zeigler, who is a metallurgist who keeps warning Lord Peary and other people who of a contracting company. Lord Peary, of course, was the head of Harlan & Wolff, who built the Titanic. And, of course, he was supplied by another company he can subtract to get the steel. And this metallurgist is constantly trying to refer to the quality of the steel that's being put into that ship. High carbonized, very brittle, and not able to withstand a whole lot of stress. And it's a very good series. I recommend it highly.
It sounds worth the watch. Unfortunately, I don't get Encore on my two dented tomato cans and a string cable system here, so I'm kind of out in the cold.
And it also deals with the labor disputes between the workers at the Belfast shipyard and how they were trying to seek a living wage. And, of course, how management deflected and did everything they possibly could to keep these workers in their place. You know, these men who went to the shipyard daily and threw hot rivets and had to hammer them into place. And it was pretty hard work and very grueling and demanding, and how there was no relief, as this series points out, for men who were injured on the job. And I don't know how many people were killed when Titanic was built, or the Olympic, or the other ships, or whatever. But there were no safety programs. There were no means of taking care of a man's family, except by the efforts made by the union, which is also pointed out in this series, Titanic, Blood and Steel. It's just not entertainment, Bob. It's very didactic in its mode and its medium and its message. And I would suggest very strongly that you take a look at it when you have a chance through DVD or whatever medium you have.
Hopefully it'll hit Netflix.
Well, I'm sure everything does hit Netflix, doesn't it? They're going to sell whatever they can sell, but who knows? Maybe somebody will say, well, no, we don't want anybody to think that Titanic went down because it was built out of inferior materials. We don't want that. We don't want to have any corporate structure being damaged in its reputation.
Right, naturally. Oh, a follow-up from Beth on the Baker streaking.
That seems to have a lot of people on their mind.
She said, well, no, she wanted to clear something up for you about the shaving cream. She says, no, tell Jim that the point of the shaving cream is that people line up to throw cold water on them as they run. So they start out with shaving cream, and they end up after the run with none. And Dr. John also pointed out, he said, Baker 13 is true. He says, my high school French teacher told us about that from her days at Rice. She said they'd jump up against walls trying to leave body prints from the shaving cream, and she was in her 60s. Very much looked like anyone's grandmother. That story left us all highly impressed.
Well, I mean, all of this is about shaving cream and running up against walls and having cold water thrown on you. Doesn't that kind of take the fun out of it?
Well, I don't know. The cold water depends on whether you're a spectator or a spectatee.
Well, obviously, if you're streaking or whatever, but I mean, I never saw any of that. I never saw any shaving cream or any people being hosed down or whatnot.
No, this is a specific tradition there. Apparently, Rice is divided into residential colleges, much like Oxford and Cambridge, and sort of to a certain extent, the same way Yale and Harvard were.
Well.
So Baker is one of those, and you get randomly selected into one of the colleges, because they're basically residential halls.
Uh-huh. And where is this place located?
Rice University in Texas.
In Texas?
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised.
I think it's in the general, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Isn't it in the general Houston area?
I don't know. I don't know where Rice is.
I know they're the Owls. They are the Rice Owls.
Anyway, I have no concern with that. I just was referring back to University of South Carolina when they had the big streak and all that stuff, and it was just incredible. Because it was real strange because the university president had people over from Oxford the night of the big streak, and a whole bunch of them had crowded outside the president's house, and, you know, his guests were there, these very tall and very stately British couple from, I think it was Oxford or a major British university, who were there as his guests. And the university president at the time lived in a penthouse building where I lived, and I lived across like the hall from it. Dr. Patterson, I used to borrow his typewriter. And before he moved over to become university president, that's where he lived. That's how I knew him And I could go on and on about those days in 1974, but that's not accomplishing anything for this program, nevertheless. There it is, and there you have it.
Well, but thank you for the streaking story. If there is anybody in the Horn family, and I mean this as a compliment, if there was anyone in the Horn family, we could expect to pick up the phone and say, "Been there, done that." It's you, Jim, and that's one of the marvelous things you bring to this whole long ongoing conversation.
Well, I appreciate the accolade and the compliment. I mean, some people have been places and seen things, and I've been things and seen places and done a lot of wild stuff in my life, and I wouldn't change a single bit of it if I could, you know, relive or whatever. It was all a lot of fun. Nobody was hurt. It was shocking to a lot of people at the time, but it was just an expectation or expectation, or what am I trying to say here? I'm not in very good form tonight. I don't feel well at all.
Sorry to hear that.
It was, yeah, me too. It was basically youthful exhilaration.
Exuberance, even.
Yeah, and exuberance in a very troubled time. I mean, the 70s were not exactly the days of wine and roses. There were a lot of things going on then. A lot of mores were being challenged, and a lot of things were being done by young people at that time to express.
Right, and I think what we see out of this is that in.
I mean, look what happened in the 70s. I mean, take it year by year. I mean, I think you had someone who referenced the Kent State killings in Ohio in, what was it, 1970?
Yeah.
And then, of course, in 1971 through 75, you had the Vietnam experience and a lot of things that were going on there. And, of course, you had a president being forced to resign from office. And you had so many other things coming through. The election of President Carter, which I thought was a pretty good thing. And then, of course, you had
Watergate, the resignation of Nixon, the prosecution of the Watergate thugs.
And then you had, of course, the business in San Francisco with Harvey Milk and things of that nature. I mean, you had, there were periods of high hope. And then complete letdown.
And now, in 2012, we find ourselves in a culture in a state of complete clampdown. And to that extent, and to the extent that much of this flows out of the paranoia and just gut-bending fear that flowed from September 11th, 2001... You know, you can make the argument, and I would say this regardless of who was in the White House, but I sure did say it when George W. Bush was in the White House and we saw the beginnings of this clampdown. We can make the argument that Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, won because he got us to give up on the notion of an open, free, civil society, and now we are in the grips of a clampdown.
Pretty much, it would appear that way. I mean, there are people who actually, and I was talking with a congressional staffer the other day, who told me that she was afraid to leave her home.
God.
That's what she told me. And so there it is. It's Osama, in his own way, has reached out from the grave to completely change the posture and feelings of security that people used to have. And I'm going to say this and I'm going to get off here. It would appear to me, and maybe I'm just being imaginative here, but the people here and there and everywhere just appear to be so much meaner, mean-spirited.
Well, fascism will make you mean, Jim. Fascism is a mean business. I mean, the very word from which we get the word fascism, the fasces of ancient Rome, was the bundle of rods and an axe that the lictors would use to beat back the hoi polloi from around the one percenters whom they were charged with guarding.
Well,
fascism, you know, just plain out brutish meanness, especially by authority figures, goes hand in hand with fascism.
I didn't realize they were actually used to combat. I thought they were basically a symbol of power and unity. That's what I've always.
Well, but they were. They also had a very. They had a very real purpose.
Well, I mean,
you know, if you were Caesar, for instance, you might have been voted 36 lictors, or 24 maybe. But if you were just the curule ideal, you only got 6, or something like that. You know, it is noteworthy that one of the reasons, for instance, Caesar was murdered is because he had dismissed his lictors, contrary to the wishes of those around him who wanted to see him continue to survive, just as JFK chose to ride in the open-topped automobile. Sometimes people make choices to go ahead and meet their fates as their fates present themselves.
Yeah, this is true. As a matter of fact, I was watching today on, I'm not sure what program it was, the Kennedy Home movies. The ones that have never been shown, and of course have been shown before, but they were very interesting to see life in the Kennedy clan. And at the end, of course, you have the bubble top thing in Dallas, and of course the bubble top car did not even have it wasn't even made of black sand, it was just pure glass. And President Kennedy was a risk taker, and he just took the wrong risk at the wrong time. Unfortunately, that will always be a very sorrowful day for me. Absolutely. Have a good night, Bob.
You take care, Jim. Bye now. Another amazing phone call from Jim. Thank you, Jim. Andy writing in. He says, I heard that Karl Marx wrote for a London newspaper and was a correspondent for the New York Tribune for a short period. Newspapers that Mr. Lincoln read. The subject line here is Abe Lincoln and Karl Marx. Karl Marx lived in London from 1849 to 1883. It's highly possible that Mr. Lincoln read Marx's editorials, if he wrote in English. I also understand that Karl Marx sent Mr. Lincoln a letter on winning his election to the presidency so this might not be that far-fetched that Mr. Lincoln knew about the philosopher. I believe that letter from Marx to Lincoln exists. By the way, I was shook down by Mayor Bloomberg's police on the way to work one day going into the subway. It wasn't pleasant, a major reason I hate, hate, hate Mayor Bloomberg, the ultimate plutocrat. The police gave me a hard time when I recited the Fourth Amendment to them. They dumped out my backpack and gym bag, having fun going through my belongings. It was humiliating. If I didn't comply, no getting on the subway. Can you say this is the Third Reich right here, right now? Fascism is as fascism does. Andy also notes Mr. Lincoln was famously known to say, paraphrasing, that the needs of labor are more important and should come before the needs of capital. He was a proponent, Andy notes, of working people. So, I don't know how this Titanic Tuesday turned into an evening of stories about the abuses of police. But Lord, there's plenty to work with, isn't there? Sandra sent this in a few minutes ago. You remember the story of Amadou Diallo? A young man, an immigrant living in the Bronx. 13 years ago, Amadou Diallo was blown away in a 41-bullet hail of homicide. One of the shooters was Officer Kenneth Boss. And the news broke on October the 2nd of this year that New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly relented and has returned his sidearm to Officer Kenneth Boss, 41 years old. He's been allowed to have the NYPD's standard 9mm weapon. One source speaking to reporters said, Kenneth Boss is relieved it's all finally over. Kenneth Boss is relieved it's all finally over. This is what he was fighting for. He thinks that he was found not guilty in criminal court. He didn't do anything wrong, so if he did nothing wrong, he should be allowed to be a cop. Five of the bullets that were fired into the 24-year-old body of Amadou Diallo in February of 1999 came from the sidearm of Officer Kenneth Boss. Being as he was a brown man, he was mistaken for a rape suspect, and they blew him to pieces when he tried to get his wallet. They mistook his wallet for a gun. You know, because so many of us carry those gun-shaped wallets. Of the 41 bullets that were fired at him, 19 found their mark. All the police officers were cleared of any wrongdoing. He was teased by his fellow police officers as Kenny No Gun. He claimed he had become a pariah in the department because he couldn't have the death engine that his fellow officers were permitted by law to carry. So he's glad to have this thing all over. Although one wonders if it is, in fact, all over even to this day for those who knew and loved Amadou Diallo. One more story from the New York Police Department. Beth sent this along. It's the story of, or the follow-up story of Tamon Robinson, a 27-year-old man. He was killed in April of this year, long about dawn. He was trying to outrun officers who were chasing him through his Brooklyn housing project. He was fleeing after he was allegedly caught stealing decorative stones from the grounds of the housing project. He wasn't gunned down. There were no 41 bullets. There were no 19 that hit him. The cops just ran over him with their car. I didn't know that stone stealing carried the death penalty. But in Michael Bloomberg's New York, Ray Kelly's New York, apparently it does. Tamon Robinson's mother is Laverne Dobinson. Laverne is 45 years old. She just got a bill. She got a bill from the New York City Police Department. She got a bill from the New York City Police Department for the sum of $710 that the New York City Police Department is demanding of her in order to pay for the dent that Tamon Robinson's corpse put in the car. Property damage to a vehicle owned by the New York City Police Department. the NYPD states in their correspondence to Ms. Dobinson that they are willing to sue her for the $710 if she doesn't pony it up. It took 6 days for Tamon Robinson to die after being run over by the New York Police Department. After being run over, he went into a coma. He never regained consciousness. City medical examiner said the death was an accident. His mama explained that he worked at a muffin shop, but he also tried to make extra money selling stuff like paving stones to scrap dealers. The case is not closed. Internal Affairs is looking into allegations from witnesses who saw him get run down, that he was deliberately run down. But in the meantime, the New York Police Department would like $710. Thank you very much for Tamon Robinson's having had the unmitigated temerity to dent the police cruiser in the process of dying. Yeah, I know. Tough to stomach, isn't it? It's another one of those moments in the banality of evil where somebody inside the NYPD administrative division just pushed a button on a computer and it generated a letter to Tamon's mama reminding her and helping her to relive in all its horror the moment she found out she did not any longer have a son. And somewhere in some office in New York City, there's a lawyer who will gladly send a paralegal down to the courthouse to file the lawsuit and have a process server knock on Tamon's mama's door and hand her the complaint and compel her to go into court and try to defend the notion against the notion that she should pay for the dent in the car caused when her son was run over like a dog in the street. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Eleven minutes past the hour. We've got about 45 minutes of good conversation space remaining in this Titanic Tuesday evening edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. You know the number, 877-443-2366, or the direct dial number, 304-658-3333. Either way, it comes into the same magic phone box, and just jump in the queue. The conversation is fine. Jack in Shreveport noting, under the subject line, cops almost always cleared. The law is arranged such that cops are made immune to almost every possible lawsuit a wrong citizen might try to bring. And that's true. Because, among other things, the Supreme Court of the United States has created a good faith exception, a so-called good faith exception, for just about everything that the police might wrongfully do to a citizen of this country, or, God forbid, a non-citizen or a new citizen or a legal resident or, well, you get the idea. Tim from L.A. writing in saying, well, here's some good news out of New York. And to wit, Daniel Williams, shooting victim, Maysu gunmaker. Story from the Huffington Post. Former high school athlete who was shot in 2003 may sue the companies that made and distributed the handgun used in the crime under an appellate court ruling that gun control advocates say will keep irresponsible gun makers and sellers from taking advantage of a federal law shielding them from lawsuits. The appellate division of the New York State Supreme Court has reversed a lower court's 2011 dismissal of Daniel Williams' complaint. The complaint accused Ohio gunmaker High Point and distributor MKS Supply, Inc. of Ohio of intentionally supplying handguns to irresponsible dealers because they profited from sales to the criminal gun market. Hell, I don't know why you couldn't bring a RICO action against these thugs. But note, shooting victim may sue gun maker, not shooting victim sues gun maker. So we shall see if the suit continues. He was 16 years old, Daniel Williams was, when he was shot by a gang member in a case of mistaken identity as he played basketball outside his home. He took a bullet to the stomach, and that ended his hopes of a Division I college basketball career. God. Marty says, by the way, thanks, Jim. Titanic Blood and Steel is airing now. See how we help each other out? Let's go to the phones.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
I don't know. I'm sitting here going, Jesus. You covered a lot of ground tonight, man. That I saw some things happen. The search and seizure police thing became much more potent during the Reagan administration. If my memory is correct.
Yes, it did.
And, I remember driving a buddy of mine who was a guitar player, acoustic player in those days, and I'm driving him home because he didn't have a car, and he had real long hair, and a cop stops us, of course, because why not?
Because he had real long hair.
Yeah, and that was, he said, oh, is that your girlfriend? And, of course, I had to bite my tongue and said, no, it's probably your wife is my girlfriend. But, you know... you can't say things sometimes that come to mind quickly.
Yeah. Now, why? Does he look like your wife?
Exactly. Something like that. Exactly. Because
well, that'll get you killed, Bill.
Yeah. Well, in those days, I don't know, about mid-60s, it got you killed, but it got me busted for sure. On some, they would have made some...
get you killed now.
Oh, yeah. That's what's so scary is that... so many things have happened, and there's a tie-in with this interesting explanation about the fascist coat of arms too. I was not aware of that. Your knowledge of ancient history makes me feel like a moron.
Well, I mean, Jim's right. They were symbolic, but they were. But symbols are always cast from reality, Bill.
Yeah.
And most assuredly, you know, the name fascism was coined after the word fascist. The name fascist was coined after the Foss case.
Yeah.
Because Mussolini's brutes and thugs went about beating their opposition into submission.
Yes, sir.
And by the way, you said that the Fourth Amendment took a beating in the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
A classic case in point is the 1984 Supreme Court case, and I've mentioned it on the show before. It's worth a read. U.S. v. Leon. And it's a case that arose out of Burbank, California. The cops got a tip that identified one Patsy Stewart and Armando Sanchez as drug dealers. So the cops began surveillance of their homes. And then they followed leads based on the cars, this is all from Wikipedia, that frequented the residences. They then identified one Ricardo del Castillo and Alberto Leon as being involved in the operation. So then the cop went and got himself an affidavit, filled out an affidavit for a search warrant. And then they executed the search warrant. But the search warrant was found to be severely lacking in probable cause. So the defendants tried to sue and to exclude the evidence. And the majority opinion said that the exclusionary rule was designed to deter unlawful police action, not punish the errors of magistrates. So the cops got away scot-free.
Yeah.
And there's other cops out there. I mean, there's other stories out there, other cases out there, where the cops get a search warrant for 112 Oak Street, and instead they go barreling through the door of 114 Oak Street. Maybe they kill somebody or they terrorize some children. Remember, and this goes back a little ways, when Sammy Alito was being considered for confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States, it was pointed out that as an appellate court judge, he had upheld the strip searching of a 9-year-old little girl during a police drug raid under the reasoning, so-called, that drug dealers often plant their drugs on innocent children. I hate that kind of so-called reasoning, Bill, because that's the same kind of reasoning that gives us, for instance, when the Israelis were bombing apartment complexes in Beirut that had little children living in them and, you know, killing them and stuff, they said, well, that's where the terrorists are. They deliberately hide their stuff. Bullshit.
There's a talk show on college radio here on Sunday night, a couple hours of it. And there's one guy that, they had a guy on the other night who was talking about a lot of people I knew from the 60s, poets and musicians and people I knew who they were, and I'd talk, because they're the same, the guys you were talking about were my generation. And here comes this one caller, one Republican, the pig licker. He calls constantly, and before 5 minutes are out, he's throwing that word communist around. And, you know, I wish I could reinvent that old comedic telephone thing, you know, where a boxing glove comes out of the phone and knocks the guy in his can, or a pie comes out, and cause this guy burns me. These kind of people burn me. They just communism is, yeah, our biggest trading partner. You mean the commie fascist Chinese? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, as I think I noted on the program last night, and I think it's kind of important. The whole time that we were worried about the communists lighting up the world with nuclear weapons, it turns out that the good God-fearing capitalists were destroying the world, or trying to, drilling for oil, drilling for gas, blowing up mountains, doing whatever they could to commoditize and liquidate every last part of this planet.
Yep.
You know, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine earlier today, and he said it concerns me that we tend to talk in terms of destroying the planet. He said we need to understand really deeply that the planet is not going to be destroyed.
We will be destroyed.
The ability of the planet to sustain human life,
yep,
is what we're destroying. And there's a big difference between the two.
It's like they and what astounds me, maybe I'm stupid, but these people can't get enough money. They cannot get enough. And times in my life...
Well, the word enough does not appear in their vocabulary.
To survive. And survival to me meant reliable cars. They didn't have to be new, but I had the money to buy tools and air compressors and the ability to read a book and learn how to repair the darn car and background in electronics, which put me a leg up on a lot of guys because I could understand the theory. And if I didn't drop something under the middle of a car at least once every job, I wasn't trying too hard. Then you had to crawl around looking for a bolt. But by the time you were done, our guy wanted $250 to do the old lady's radiator on a LeSabre. I pulled it and took it to a friend of mine. He gave me a recore for $100 and I slapped it back in. The whole thing took me about 2.5 hours and I saved her $150. Or saved us. You know, and that was why the guys that I listened to, the uncles and the old man and the Depression generation, you did that kind of stuff. You worked on your house. You did whatever you could to save a dollar, you know. But then there's people who cannot get enough. Mr. Raw Money the other night, if you'd have turned the sound down on that so-called debate, you couldn't have figured out whether he was selling used cars or carpets.
Right, and I just got a visual in from Shorty in L.A., and it's hilarious. Yeah, that rather not safe for work audio that I played last night, where Big Bird refers to Mitt Raw Money as "you Frankenstein looking mf'er."
Yeah.
Well, and this just brought it all home when I saw this visual from Shorty. Do you realize that the Republicans are running Herman and Eddie Munster for president and vice president of the United States?
Yeah, I've heard it. I've heard the one guy. That could be a good brawl. You know, two Irish guys having an argument could be a. In the old days, would have been a hell of a show.
But this is. I mean, God, this country.
Yeah. Another thing I was going to bring up was, you know, you're familiar with the New York draft rights.
Yes.
And a mob tore
1862
out of the police. In the opening days of that. And what was the mob made up of as far as ethnicity?
Irish?
You got it. And if you read the background of the one book that I had of how miserable the Irish immigrant was living.
Oh, Jesus. New York in 1860 was no place to be poor.
Nope.
And in fact, a lot of people, Bill, for instance, will talk about how the life expectancy in America has grown.
I think it's going to drop.
Well, it is going to drop, but the point is, the reason the life expectancy was so low is that it was taking into account people who were dying like flies in the filth of our cities.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, I've got forebears in the dirt around here that were living into their 90s.
Yes, yes. And medicine was not that far advanced. No, but
they were not. This is the section of my family that was not involved in coal mining, I might add.
Yeah, that was a toughie.
They were farmers. They ate pig grease, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
But they worked like dogs.
Damn good tasting, wasn't it?
No, it was right tasty. And you know, gravy and biscuits, but they had good green fresh things out of their farm gardens and so forth. And they lived, you know, they lived to very old ages.
Yeah.
But that was not the case inside the cities. And so, you know, we need to take that into account. I find it ironic, by the way, I was going to mention that, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis had the lead in that Martin Scorsese film, The Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, now he's playing Abraham Lincoln from roughly the same time period.
Well, that's a good actor if he can handle both.
Oh, he's a magnificent actor.
You know, that's, you guys, you know, talking about the, what I liked about the Goodfellas, for instance, it showed you that Godfather stuff is not what, you know.
No, the, you know, Mario Puzo set out to create a morality tale.
Yes.
And he did so using, using the mob as his backdrop.
Yeah.
But it's a morality tale, basically. It's a fable that it's made much more interesting because it's the mob. But what he's talking about really is corporate America.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's almost a nobility, a noblesse, if you will, in the Corleone family that did not, if you watch something like Goodfellas, that did not obtain. We're talking about brutes.
Yeah, my dad's brother, due to the fact that he was an early electronics guy and he could do jukeboxes and pinball and cigarette machines and you name it. In fact, when I stopped at his house when I was a little child, maybe 6-7 years old, there was six one-armed bandits on the floor he was working. He worked close to the fellas. He wasn't one of the fellas because he was German. But, so I had a good, and in fact, his closeness to the fellas saved my old man a long time in jail when they busted my father in 1946 with a pound of reefer. But the uncle, connections, set up a nice $1,000 bribe. You know, corruption is new in our society.
Yeah, not.
Well, that's why I love the Prism series, because these men, they're filling in a lot of holes for me. I was weak on the revolution and the constitutional setups and such. I had feelings about them that we were taught. And hell, when I was in grade school, we were taught more. A buddy of mine's a lifetime teacher of social studies and history, and when we met, he was shocked. I almost fell off the bar stool. He'd come out, and I was playing someplace, and we were yakking in the break, and how did you learn all that stuff? I said, it's all in a book somewhere. And if you read two or three or four books on the same subject, and you try to draw out the truth amongst all of it, you, at least you get some idea of what was going on.
Yeah, but if you tune into these Prism chats with Dr. Bill and Professor Keith, Bill, I think you'll agree with me that what you get there is history that you really have to know what you're looking for in order to go and find it.
Yeah. They bring it out and they point you in certain areas and directions.
By the way, I think you just got a high compliment. Shorty in L.A. just wrote in and said, Bill sounds like Studs Terkel.
Yeah, I wish. I read his stuff, Division Street and the Great Depression. And yeah, we live in a world which I refer to, and I've heard other people use it too. It's not my original. The short attention span theater. I hear these kids on Sunday night, and this one guy, he's 30, and he can build a computer. My 80-year-old uncle was doing that. I assembled for a buddy of mine in the early 90s. It's not a, and today it's a lot easier than it was then. But I had that TV background, which helped a lot. You know, electronics helps
right
an awful lot. But, and then he started talking about his online girlfriend. And that took me, here's a funny one. I brought a TV back to a guy after I fixed it, wasn't it? And when he's talking to me, he pays me. I'm happy now, he pays me. And the thing worked, or made me even happier. He said, you want to see some pictures of my girlfriend? So he goes and pulls out this brown envelope and pulls out these 8x10 glossies with an imprinted signature, the kind of stuff bands used to use. I've seen them before, you know. And I'm going, oh, yeah, okay. And he says, yeah, and she writes me a letter. Now, this is 1976. And so he reaches in and he pulls out these letters, Bob. Remember the stuff you got in the second grade for a test? Mimeographed?
Oh, yeah.
That's what these letters were. And so I hit this young kid with that. I said, it reminds me of that story. Boy, did he get hot with me. But Come on, man. Get out there and live. You're 30 years old. What the hell are you doing sitting around the house playing video games? Come on. We were out where it was going on. And sometimes I...
You know, there's a big difference between playing rock star with your plastic push-button guitar...
Yeah.
...and learning the real deal.
Yeah, we just went out and played. I did some early apprenticeship jobs, and bars, what were referred to as the ghetto in those days, were the only white pussies belonged to me and a couple other guys on stage. And nobody threw us the hell out or beat the hell out of us. So I said, well, we're doing something, man. We're doing something decent.
Yeah. By the way, Irish Dave recommends another film, Bill.
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time in America.
Yes.
He says, fairly good history, lousy box office. Guess why?
Why? None of violence?
Oh, no, because it's fairly good history.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too. I like The Bronx Tale quite a bit in some ways. Except I saw the reverse of the bikers versus the gangsters. There was a bar, there was a neighborhood right close to where your dad was in the Cleveland Clinic called Little Italy.
Oh, I went up into Little Italy.
Good food.
That's why I went.
Yeah, excellent, excellent food. Still is. And, oh, God, one bakery up there, and, oh, jeez. Man, nothing beats a good loaf of Italian bread in my book, except maybe a good loaf of Jewish rye. Excuse me, I have to call that traditional rye. We have a outfit here which is a what do they call those things that you buy? A franchise. And they make good Jewish rye, but they call it traditional because they don't want to insult anybody. But me, my first wife is Jewish, and we lived in a neighborhood with Jewish bakeries, and after the end of Shabbos, you go out on a Saturday, late Saturday, early Sunday, and get a loaf of that fresh bread. Man, oh, brother. Ooh, don't even get me started.
I'll never forget the first time that the young woman I was seeing at the time, her dad got up on a Sunday morning, and this was in Atlanta, so, I mean, for what it is. But he got up on a Sunday morning, went out to the deli, and brought home piping hot fresh bagels and made salami and eggs and onions.
Oh, yeah.
Holy mackerel. I don't know, maybe he just made it with love or something, but I've never been able to replicate it. Oh, my God, it was good. And by the way, you got a big amen from Jug of Punch in the chat room, Bill. He says, I love Little Italy.
Yeah, well, my first wife and I, there was a restaurant up there that was more college-priced as opposed to some of the others, which were pretty high-priced. And that was because I worked music in University Circle in one place from 71 to 78, and the next one down the street less than a half a mile from 78 to 96. So that neighborhood, and I was drinking in the neighborhood and 3-2 beer in 61 when I was 18.
Sure.
So that college neighborhood had been like a second home to me. I had friends going to Case when working men's kids could afford to go there. And they'd drag me in. There was a DJ named Bill Randall up here in Cleveland. And Randall brought Elvis into a couple of high schools here in 55. And he did a communications class, and I would go in and monitor that because I had to hear this guy, you know, because I listened to him on the radio. It was a fine time to listen to music, because you notice I asked you about Representative Fuqua.
Yes.
You know who Harvey Fuqua was then.
I'm trying to remember.
Harvey and the Moon Glows.
Okay, yeah.
And he was a producer for Motown in later life. I don't think they were related. Jesus. These people are frightening. You know, there are times when I look at my age and I say, man, you don't want to be this age. Then I hear about people like him and say, well, maybe it's not such a bad place after all.
Yeah. By the way, Jug of Punch in the chat room said, my uncle got the hell out of Cleveland when Danny Green and his car were blown up.
Yeah. That was another story. My kid was playing guitar for me at the time, was delivering flowers as a part-time job, and he arrived about 20 minutes after that event. And then other buddies of mine were longshoremen, because Green ran the docks for a while. And he was replaced by a guy from West Virginia whose first name, believe it, you'll love this one, the guy's first name was Percy.
Percy.
Yeah. I can think about what it would be like to grow up in West Virginia with the first name of Percy.
You might find your way out of West Virginia if you were lucky.
Well,
by the way, this is Cleveland Memories, the Cleveland Memories segment of the program, Bill.
Yeah.
Waggy in the chat room referenced Presti's Donuts, very near the Case campus, opens very early, convenient when dropping acid, Waggy says.
Yeah, we would go up, Presti's Bakery made bread in the donut shop. There'd be a fresh load of donuts coming out about closing time on a Saturday night, and I'd stop and buy a dozen and get home and lie to my wife about how I only bought a half a dozen.
Yeah.
I was within 45 minutes east of, or 30 minutes it took me on dry pavement to get to Lake County. And because I frankly got sick and tired of the inner city, I sent Rick Smith a poster from these projects that I was spent from 48 to 60 in. And Rick commented on it the other night, and he wrote back to me because he grew up in one on the west side of Cleveland. We kind of share that project kid mentality, you know.
Yeah.
I'll let you go, but you hit it on the nose tonight. This and the cops that I hung around and fished with that were Vietnam vets, they were a different breed. A couple of them told me they had gone up against guys who were every bit as tough as they were.
Yeah.
And guys who knew their job, the Viet Cong and the NVA, they were good combat soldiers. If there's such a thing. I mean, I should say efficient maybe is a better word. And it's so amazing, Bernard Fall in his study in D&B and Fu, he talked about the Legionnaires, and he mentioned that, you know, Fall was like Ernie Pyle of the French Expeditionary Corps in Indochina. And he wrote about guys fighting the D&B and Fu who had joined the Legion because they were on the losing side in the Spanish Civil War. And they were still, this is all they knew to do for a living. And, you know, carry a rifle, go out and put your, you know. Now, those cops were different. A lot of them didn't have to prove anything to anybody.
But all of that, changes in the national security state.
Yeah.
Isaac wants to know, ask Bill if he remembers the Dynamite Kid in Cleveland.
I remember a guy using that name, yeah. But it was a performer that had that name. In fact, I've got some stuff sent to me on him over the years. This was a great music town in its day because of the there was a book available that covered 54 to 56 and all the acts that came through town, and one guy who was supposed to be here and at a place called the Loop Lounge downtown was Charlie Parker, and he didn't make it because of his, and see, that's what always kept me away from the nasty drug like heroin. I looked at people like Parker and Billie Holiday, and I said, these people have 1,000 times more talent than I'll ever have. And they couldn't deal with it. So stay away from that stuff.
Meanwhile, the further questions for Bill roll in. Andy wants to know, you ever heard of Rodriguez from Detroit? Wants to know if you've seen the movie Searching for Sugarman, and what do you think?
I've heard of it, but I never saw it. What I know of Detroit was the Grandy Ballroom.
Oh, okay. I have your answer here. Dynamite Kid blew up. Isaac says this guy blew up shit in Youngstown and Cleveland.
Okay, there was a situation in 71. I was crossing an intersection of Mayfield and Coventry. I was on my way to a party, a Halloween party. I got two blocks south of where the light was, and I hear a blast. Green had just blown up a guy that worked for him, which they thought was an accident, and that later turned to be a truism. Yeah, there was a guy who was a bomb maker too for a while down in Little Italy.
I mean, it's amazing. This is Cleveland old home night, Bill. Shorty in L.A. wants you to know I grew up off 83rd and Stony Island.
83rd and Stony Island. That's got me. Is that West Side?
That I don't know. we will get an answer in short order, though, I'm quite sure.
I know lots of the East Side, because one thing we did when I was in the eighth grade, you'd buy a Sunday bus pass for 50 cents and just ride all over the city for a day, me and two or three other guys. Because we had that kind of inquisitiveness. Hell, when I got to Toronto in 76, I'm riding a streetcar. And I said to my first wife, I said, I've been on these kind of cars before. So I started yakking with the motorman. He says, yeah, you were on these all right. We bought these from Cleveland in 54. I said, oh, good, you know. Toronto, have you ever been there, Bob?
I have not.
That is a city to see, and it's changing rapidly. It was something, 76 reminded me of 1950s in Cleveland. But
Well, meanwhile, the name dropping continues. Jug of Punch noting the Corbos in Little Italy is something special.
Yeah, Corbos, Dulceria, the best, what the hell do they, cannolis I ever had in my life, yes. I had an Italian insurance guy, and he'd stop by, and he was a guy that was a friend as well as a guy who bought insurance from him. He'd bring in Italian food from the hill and cook it, and he'd bring cannolis for dessert. It's been an interesting time.
Shorty noting, no, that's Chicago, not far from Cottage Grove.
Oh, okay.
83rd and Stony Island.
Yeah, I was down on around Cottage Grove in 67. The guys I was playing with, we went to Chicago and Detroit back-to-back days, or 2 days in each. And we stopped at a jam session in the South Side. And let me tell you something, for a guy who was 24 at the time, to go into an all-black bar in Chicago and get on the stage and work and play a set with these guys was like, it was like, where's the pearly gates for guys like us to do that? You know, it was a thrill, but it was a different lifestyle. We worked in Detroit. We opened for Cream in 68, MC5. One night it was Steppenwolf. It was the top act, and Three Dog Night was the middle.
Wow.
I got up to Detroit early because we had a sound check stuff. And we got bumped off a gig with a group called Led Zeppelin. We were replaced by a group called Gold Earring.
Oh, God, Golden Earring with the world's most patient drummer. Chunka, 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 chunka. For 7 minutes.
Yeah. Well, they paid for the trip, so, you know, because there was cell phone. 1968? What?
Yeah.
And you could buy posters, but... you could dig them out of the Grandy Ballroom, had a website up there, the guy that made the posters. The West Coast Fillmore and places like that, they developed a whole poster style. It was, the psychedelic poster was amazing. And it was a good time to be playing because there was just one night a guy came in, a harmonica player named Tim Wilson from the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Made me wish I practiced more that day. That guy was so damn good. But he went down a basement with me, and we investigated some of these. We were so broke we had to share a cigarette, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
Anyway, I'll let you go because there's other people that always have stuff to talk about this.
Well, Bill, there's plenty to talk about when you call, and I sure do appreciate all the places you take.
The thing about history, Bob, is all this stuff runs together somewhere.
Right, and the trick is finding the intersection point and understanding where and why.
I wish I could get a comment from the Dr. Bill and the other professor about my friend's use of the term that knowing something that happened in the 30s is irrelevant today. That just burns. Because this kid that told me that, we grew up in the projects together, and this guy is one of the people who forgot where he came from.
Well, that's one of those people who's going to be doomed to repeat some history.
Well, he's made himself a lot of money because he could chisel anything, this guy. And legally.
Yeah.
Well, he was head of PR for a big company, and you know what a public relations man is, a paid raconteur, you know?
Yeah. Or, as you noted, chiseler.
Yes. Anyway, take care of yourself, man.
All right, you take care, Bill. It's awful good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Good night.
Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. I am so... God, I'm... I know things, I learn things, I have conversations that I would never have around here. This program, whatever it is that you get out of it from me, or I get as much going in the other direction. Because like I said, I've realized I'm never going to go the places I want to go. And I've realized that even if you're a tourist, you're not going to see and experience what it is you want and what it is you hope to gain, because you have to live in a place. I'm reading a novelized version of the Journeys of Marco Polo right now. And you know, when he got to the court of Kublai Khan, he was 17 years there before he came back to Venice, and upon his return was immediately slapped in irons because and held by the Genoese because of the war going on between the Viennese and the Venetians and the Genoese. And that's when he began putting together the travel log that became, and when it was published, he was called Marco of the Millions, because most people assumed that he was simply lying about everything. But he was able to travel it and live it and become part of the world. It's one of the failings of so-called tourism. To be a tourist is not to be a part of anything, but simply to blow by it. And so when I hear stories from Bill, or the kind of stories that Jim tells, or stories referencing a streaking culture at Rice University, I'm made the better for it. Because though I may never go there, at least I have some small taste of what the reality of there is. And to a certain extent, for those of you who will never come to Appalachia, I hope you can get some sense of what life is here from me. Although I do far too good a job, I fear sometimes, of telling you about the bad side of this place, because the bad side so thoroughly obscures the rich and the good. I need to work on that some. But also, I hope, inherent in the fact that I'm willing to talk about what goes on here at such length, bears with it the knowledge or the understanding that we only stay here and struggle because this place is worth saving. Shorty writing in says, "You remind me of the experience of reading. When you read, you always travel to someplace new and exciting." And that's where I do most of my traveling these days. The Marco Polo book, it's called Journeyer by Gary Jennings. He's the same guy who wrote Aztec. It's really fun reading this now, because I can sit and go and immediately research the things that he's bringing up and find out, because, you know, this thing was published in 1984 and the work for it had been years in the making. And there's not a lot of, you know, he's just filling in gaps. There's some imagination going on, but the places he refers to and the stuff that he refers to historically, they're quite real. And he creates an utterly fascinating character in Kublai Khan, the Khan of all Khans. I'd like to figure out a way to do a little more real-time, long-term traveling. It's like going to Madison. I was there for a little more than 24 hours. Got there about 3 o'clock on a Friday. Left at 9 o'clock on Sunday. And what I gathered from that time there was that I needed a lot more time there. Some places I've gone to and felt real good about leaving. No offense to anybody who lives there. Vegas was one of those. it was just all wrong for me. Of course, staying in a casino hotel might have contributed to that, because once again, it wasn't a matter of living the life, because what happens in a casino is some sort of fantasy. But, you know, getting to spend 2 or 3 days down in Selma, Alabama, and getting to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, that's life-changing. That, because it shifts your perspective. The couple of days that I got to spend up in Boston, in the Boston area, a place I had always wanted to go. Because, as Bill notes, all these things intersect. And the intersections have a way of happening not in history, but in us. And it's transformative. So I guess we're getting pretty close to the end of tonight's program, and I don't want to open up any cans of off-topic trouble. But since so-called criminal justice and the abuses of that system have found their way to the top of our discussion this evening, we'll close with this. A little lesson in capitalism. A little lesson in what Bishop Willard Romney, that Frankenstein-looking said during the pageant last week. He casually dropped that same old tired chestnut that the right wing is forever dropping, that the private sector can do it better and cheaper. Well, there is no better manifestation of that philosophy and the failure of it than the warehousing of human beings, which is another way of saying the prison system. The very first privately owned, corporatized, profitized, commercialized, monetized state prison is in the state of Ohio. And it is owned and it is run by Corrections Corporation of America, which sounds so Orwellian that it almost sounds unreal, but it is very real. One of the largest private prison companies in the U.S., CCA. They also run the T. Don Hutto Young People's Warehouse in Texas, I believe. Well, in Ohio, a paper called City Beat has published an article about the first privately owned state prison in the United States. Here's the takeaway from the article. The local fire plan had no specific steps to release inmates from locked areas in case of emergency, and local employees said they had no idea what they should do in case of a fire. The audit also found all housing units provided less than the required 25 square feet on unencumbered space per occupant. It found single watch cells held two prisoners, with some sleeping on the floor, and some triple bunk cells had a third inmate sleeping on a mattress on the floor. Inmates claimed laundry and cell cleaning services were not provided. CCA could not prove otherwise. Recreation time was not always allowed 5 times a week, and segregation is required. Food quality and sanitization was not up to standard. Infirmary patients were not seen timely. Patients' doctor appointments were often delayed, with follow-ups rarely occurring. The facility had no written confined space program. The health care administrator could not explain or show an overall plan, and nursing competency evaluations were not completed before the audit was conducted. Many more issues, CityBeat reports, were found as well. And you know why all that is? Of course you do. Because all of those things take away from corporate profits. You want us to feed them real food? Well, damn, that'll take a millionth of a penny off the quarterly share price. What do we tell the stockholders? That we were feeding them? There are some things in this world that are not meant to be touched by the profiteering impulse. And our prisons, tragedy-ridden as they are, should probably top that list. So there it is, the end of the program, the end of Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. Thank you, everyone, for all your thoughts, your emails. Thank you for your conversation. Thank you for your continued kind support. Thank you for the kind and generous contribution received this evening that leaves us in need of only $50 to come even before we start tomorrow evening's program. We started out $150 in the hole. Now we're only $50, and thank you very much for making that the way it is. If we can catch up with the other $50 between now and tomorrow evening, more the better. Because that's how this continues. That's not, you know, the $2,500 we try to raise every month is not a wish list. It is the necessity of what it takes to continue having this little experiment that will be 7 years old on October the 24th. A scant 15 days from now. So thanks go out, as always, to all of those who make all of this happen. Our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, our moderators in the chat room, our blogger Texas Betsy, our news ninjas Gene and Susan, my lovely wife Agnes. Thanks to John Fox in Australia for all he does, keeping the websites up and running and keeping me at something resembling sane, dealing with an aging equipment list. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. It's been 10 years now that Ben Birch has been running the White Rose Society. It's been 10 years that he's been preserving, archiving, protecting, keeping, and perpetuating liberal and progressive radio on the Internet. And he's never sent a bill. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT.org. Go to ACHEACT.org and learn what you can do to become a part of the end of Appalachia's agony. Advocate for H.R. 5959, the ACHE Act. Call your congressman. Thank them if they've signed on. Tell them it's time to get serious about making Appalachian Americans real Americans by signing on if they haven't. Go to CRMW.net and buy the coolest t-shirt in the world, the Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt. It's cheap, and it is a conversation starter wherever you wear it, whenever you wear it. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.